Up next, former ABC journalist Gail Tzemach-Lemon describes how the rise of the Taliban changed the life of Kher Khana, an Afghan woman who went from being a teacher to working as a dressmaker to support her family. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC support comes from Symphony Space, presenting selected shorts, the 40th anniversary of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson, with Michael Imperioli, Scott Shepard, Anthony Rapp, Terry McDonnell, and Chuck Klosterman, tomorrow at 7. Tickets at selectedshorts.org. Freud's Last Session, a play about an imagined meeting between legendary psychoanalyst Dr. Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. Bloomberg News says the two brilliant men engage in a brainy fencing match of Olympic caliber. Tickets at freudslastsession.com.
WNYC is giving away a limited number of tickets to see the Juilliard Orchestra. James DePriest conducts Mahler's Symphony No. 5 and Itamar Zorman and Berg's Violin Concerto, March 25th at Avery Fisher Hall. Enter to win. Click on giveaways at WNYC.org.
The 92nd Street Y supports WNYC and presents Family Music, a concert about the life and music of Ludwig van Beethoven, on Sunday, March 20th at 3. Among the performers are cellist Steven Isserles and soprano Heidi Grant Murphy, who also narrates the event. Information, 92y.org. WNYC is giving away three pairs of tickets for Sunday, starting with the fourth call. To reach us at 646-829-3985. But please note, if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days, you're not eligible for these tickets. Camila Siddiqui's life changed overnight when the Taliban seized control of Kabul. Although she held a teaching degree, because she's a woman, Camila was banned from school and confined to her home. So she picked up a needle and thread and created a thriving business to support her family. Gail Tzemach-Lemon, a former ABC News reporter, tells Camila Siddiqui's story in The Dressmaker of Kher Khana and reveals that daily life was like for all the women in Afghanistan when the Taliban were in power. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Gail to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you.
What brought you to Afghanistan?
I went in December of 2005 to work on a Financial Times story and also a case for Harvard Business School about women entrepreneurs. Basically, everyone told me there was no story, that there were no women entrepreneurs working. But I just had read a lot about them and had heard from other people that there were women who had turned to business to support their families. And so I went to write about them.
But you arrived after the Taliban had been toppled. So were you seeing a continuation of things that had happened under the Taliban, or was the new situation encouraging more female entrepreneurship?
Actually, both. So in the book I talk about this, I had this moment where I was interviewing a young woman who was talking to me about why she had just turned down a very high-paying job with an international aid organization to start her own company. And I said, well, that's a completely crazy economic decision. Why are you doing this? She said, no, because I believe that business is the key to Afghanistan's future. And she went on to talk to me about marketing and finance and, you know, why it was business that was going to create hope for Afghanistan. And I said, well, you're not even 30. How do you know so much about business? And she turned to me and said, well, I had this great business under the Taliban. You know, they supported about 100 women in my neighborhood. And as a reporter, you just had a eureka moment.
We have a friend, former NPR reporter Sarah Chase, who started something similar. But she was working for a human rights organization, an NGO, and then decided that she'd be more effective actually creating a business. But you also write about going there with a lot of confidence. Your confidence was shaken a bit after you went through customs. What happened?
Yes, I was in customs, and the guy said to me, well, you know, you're going to write about women entrepreneurs in Afghanistan. I said, I am. And he said, well, you know, that'll take about half a day. So what are you going to do the other 2 weeks you're in Afghanistan? And I think that's actually why I wrote this book, because there were so many young women who pulled their families through an impossible time in the Taliban years and really never got credit for all the work they did. And I think it's just one story that stands for so many about what women do every day to pull families through.
So let's talk about that story. How did you meet Camila Siddiqui?
There was a non-governmental organization called BPeace, a nonprofit here in New York, that told me about this young woman who was this terrific entrepreneur. And I met her in the offices of Mercy Corps in Kabul. And when she told me that she had this terrific business under the Taliban, I just could not forget her story, because I think, like so many people, I thought that women were only under house arrest during the Taliban years. And in fact, here were these women who had found any opening they could, even during the Taliban years with all its rules. And they had really created a lifeline for their entire community.
But what does living under house arrest actually mean? Women were not allowed to travel outside their homes?
Well, you know, what it actually meant versus what the Taliban rules said were two very different things. So women were always navigating around the rules during the Taliban era. The Taliban said you cannot be out in public without a chaperone. Now, a chaperone could be a 9-year-old boy. I mean, that was the equivalent of a chaperone.
As long as it was male.
As long as they were male, exactly. And so what women did was they were taking brothers and neighbors and cousins and friends to make sure they could still do things like, as we talk about in the book, Kamala's brother Rahim was her lifeline for himself. I mean, he took her to the bazaar almost every day so that they could find shopkeepers to buy dresses. And that money gave work to more women in their neighborhood. And in the end, they supported 100 women in their neighborhood.
She didn't have a husband?
She did not. She was only 19. And, you know, while that is marrying age for many in Afghanistan, she had a father who believed in girls' education and who purposely wanted his young daughters to stay in Kabul and to continue their lessons at home and to really focus on the time after the Taliban, whenever that would be, and not marry until then.
So she, at least in theory, couldn't leave home. She had to dress in a certain way. How were those rules enforced?
So the Taliban had, and we talk there, they play a major role in the book. The vice and virtue forces were always patrolling the streets of Kabul. They were particularly in Kamala's neighborhood because that was a neighborhood from a different ethnic group in Karkana. And they would be out looking for any rule breakers. And a rule breaker could be just a woman whose burqa slipped and let her wrist show, or it could be a man whose beard wasn't long enough as their rules prescribed. And they were out all the time. And so Kamala and her brother and then the young women who were working with her really took lots of precautions. So Kamala never, ever left her house without a burqa. She had a set of rules for all the girls who were working with her, and she did her best to stay within the rules of the Taliban.
Were most of the Afghan people willing to go along with these new religious-based restrictions that the Taliban were imposing?
People really felt like they had no choice. Their lives changed so dramatically that people really were just focused on survival. And the economy collapsed, which is a story we don't think about that much in terms of the Taliban period. The economy really shattered. And so people did all they could just to feed their families. And that's why this business really mattered.
Although at the time we were told that, in fact, even by conservative groups, that the Taliban were a welcome change because the country was in such turmoil. All these various warlords were fighting each other, and one of them was shelling Kabul on a regular basis because he hadn't been given the power he thought he should have had.
That's right. And we talk about this in the book, that those 4 years leading up to the Taliban coming into Kabul were brutal for Kabul. You know, apparently about 30,000 people died. There are no exact numbers, but in Kabul in the civil war in Afghanistan. So for some people, the Taliban was a welcome relief. At the very least, the shelling stopped and things were quieter for the most part in Kabul. But if you were a woman, that was not necessarily the case because your life really changed dramatically and all your ability to contribute to your family went away overnight.
Although there were certain little safety valves. Can you tell us about the Titanic fever that spread over Kabul during this period?
Yes. We joke about this, and you see this in the chapter that talks about the Titanic. It was the one thing the Taliban couldn't stop. It was this cultural phenomenon that swept over the city. People would pass video cassettes of the Titanic movie that they had brought in from Pakistan or Iran around from neighbor to neighbor, from street to street. And there was almost no one who hadn't seen the film. And to the point that it became a marketing boon for almost anything in the city. There were Titanic vegetables, Titanic lipstick, Titanic dresses.
Why that film in particular?
I think it was because it represented something people could relate to. Doomed love, really. People who were persevering in their own way against insurmountable obstacles, people who were buffeted by forces they couldn't control. And I think people did relate to it.
I wonder how the Taliban related to the nude scene or the suggested nude scene.
Well, and you know, the Taliban even banned Titanic wedding cakes. Titanic wedding cakes were the rage for certain weddings in Kabul. And they said no more Titanic replicas on weddings.
So how did Kamala establish her sewing business? She was restricted in her movements, even if she did get help.
Absolutely. She basically started with one dress And that dress, she went to the first shopkeeper in Kabul that she knew. And when he bought it, she realized there was really a market for the dresses that she was making. So she just brought her brother into the business and said, you know, you really need to help me. And he was happy to, because everyone had to pitch in at that desperate time.
Had she been an expert seamstress before she found herself in this predicament?
She didn't know how to sew. I think, like so many educated girls all around the world, we have not learned our mother's tricks in terms of being great seamstresses. And she had never learned to sew. So what she did was, on the first day that she had the idea, she took a bus across town, actually, by herself, which was a real risk, and went to her sister's house, her older sister's house, to learn to sew. Her older sister was an expert tailor. And from that one dress grew a business that created a lifeline for 100 women.
Because she started employing more and more women. One story you tell is about Camilla and her helpers spending 2 days sewing half a dozen wedding gowns, only to find out that the wedding for the wedding groom is Talib. Now, what's the significance of being Talib?
You know, I think the fact is that the Taliban knew that young girls like Kamala were running businesses in their living rooms, that from their living rooms they had created sewing factories and businesses that were giving work to women in their neighborhood. And the Taliban needed them in some ways too, right? They still had to get married and find
wedding
dresses.
So they were looking the other way.
Absolutely.
So how did they react to the news? Were they still happy to make this for this member of the Taliban?
They were shocked, and they said, you know, look, I mean, this is a very difficult time for all of us. So a customer is a customer is a customer. It's terrific. We'll take the business.
Well, then she was making a lot of money at this point. Did she have to hide that from the authorities?
You know, because the Taliban times were so desperate, a lot of money then was simply real survival. And, you know, any money that they earned went right back out. She ended up supporting, and we talk about this in the epilogue of the book, she ended up supporting her father, who had gone to Iran because of safety risks, and her brother, who had gone to Pakistan. And she sent them money. And her father said to me, first God, then myself, and then Kamala provided for our family.
My guest is Gail Tsemach-Lemon. Her book, The Dressmaker of Kharkana, which is published by Harper. Did you find that other Afghan women were working despite the strict laws that forbade their presence in these in the workforce?
I learned so much during the reporting of this book. There were women who practiced medicine throughout the Taliban years. In fact, there's a character in the book, Dr. Mariam, who refuses to leave Afghanistan even when almost all the other women doctors she knows flee, because she said, this is my country and women need me. There were women who were community leaders. There were women who were teachers. One gal I met actually taught Microsoft Office in a hospital in Kabul, because hospitals were safe spaces that the Taliban more or less left alone.
Well, the Taliban were caught in a bind because male doctors couldn't examine women, but women doctors weren't allowed to practice medicine.
And women doctors managed also to navigate around the rules. They got an exception from the Taliban. And they would carry a piece of paper with them so that if they were stopped, they could show the Dread of Vice and Virtue Forces that they had a Ministry of Health approval that they could keep working.
So, okay, so what's happened since the fall of the Taliban? Did she go back to teaching, or has she kept her dress business going?
You know, she actually left the dressmaking business almost immediately after the Taliban fell. And we talk about this in the epilogue, that Kamala actually became an entrepreneur who is now flourishing. She's now on her third business, Kawiyan, which is a business consultancy, teaches entrepreneurship skills to Afghans around the country. And in some ways, it was the period of the Taliban that made her an entrepreneur, because she, like so many young women, was going to be a teacher. Other girls were going to be doctors or lawyers, and all of that was closed. So they did the one thing that was left to them. They became entrepreneurs.
But it's still rough for women, isn't it? I saw a documentary about a woman who entered a contest the equivalent of American Idol. And because she was a woman and she let her headscarf slip, she received death threats. There have been attacks on women teachers and girls in schools in recent years, even though education for women is now allowed. Is this from the Taliban only, or are there other people who don't want to see women attend schools?
There are a lot of people, particularly more conservative South, who are very nervous about women's roles. But what I do think you see is women taking the spaces that have been created over the past decade, going on from their work in the Taliban period, and making the most of it. I've done a lot of stories about child marriage and about domestic violence in Afghanistan, which is widespread, for the Daily Beast. And what I think I am impressed most by is the resilience of the women that I meet, which is they take any opportunity they can, and they really do their best to contribute to their families.
Now, what were the challenges you faced as an American woman reporting in Afghanistan?
Security was probably the biggest question, and that really had nothing to do with being a female, but it definitely had to do with being a foreigner, because there was a period in the fall of 2008 when kidnappings and bombings and missile attacks became fairly common in Afghanistan. In fact, one day I was reporting and I turned off my phone. I turned it back on and it was the U.S. Embassy asking me if I was the freelancer American writer who had been kidnapped. I said, no, thank you for your call, but that's actually not me and I'm perfectly fine. But security was really brutal. And I think I kept going because these girls had gone on to do so much work during a period in which they faced so much difficulty, and they were actually my inspiration.
And were these women open with you?
Afghanistan is a place where you have to work as a reporter to build trust, and I think that is as it should be. You really do need to keep showing up and to prove to people that you are there to tell their story in a way that reflects reality and not the spectacle. And I spent enough time, I learned Dari, and I talk about this in the introduction. I sort of started the introduction in Dubai's Terminal 2 changing to go to my first trip in Afghanistan as a really green foreign reporter, trying to figure out what I was going to find on the ground in Afghanistan. And I think I've in some ways grown up with this book.
Now, you were in Kabul mostly. Would the stories have been similar if you'd been in Kandahar or one of the other cities?
It's different. I think I have spent a lot of time in the north, but the south is a very different environment. But
more welcoming to the Taliban.
Much more welcoming to the Taliban and much more conservative. Women really do live in a lot in purdah, which is a separation from non-male family members. And even there, though, I have met women, a number of them, who worked all throughout the Taliban years in Kandahar. And for some women, the Taliban years were the first years they were allowed to work, because since the Taliban was in power, the men and their family felt more comfortable letting them leave the house.
And so what do you see as the future here? Because it looks like it's still kind of murky for women, isn't it?
Very. And I think the question remains, what happens next? Obviously, the U.S., you know, I saw the Washington Post poll numbers and 3/4 of Americans question the Afghan war. People are very concerned about the direction of this conflict. And I think the question now Afghan women have is, what will be our future in whatever government comes next? And will we have a seat at the table? Women desperately want peace, but they want to make sure their rights are not negotiated away in the rush to achieve it.
Gail Temack-Lemon worked as a journalist for nearly 10 years covering presidential politics and public affairs as a producer with the ABC News Political Unit and this week with George Stephanopoulos. Then she went to Afghanistan. And you quit working for Network News?
I did. I left ABC News to go to Harvard Business School in 2004. And I left – I really loved ABC, but I left because I really wanted to do stories about economic development. I thought I had to have a background to write about these things.
Gail will be giving a talk and signing books next Monday, the 21st, for the Women's Foreign Policy Group at 809 Union Plaza, 1230. For more information and to buy tickets, go to our show page at WNYC.org. Oh, that's UN Plaza. The book, The Dressmaker of Karakana, published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.